Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Sharp China. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Bill Bishop. Bill, how you doing?
I'm good, Andrew. How are you? Hi, everybody. We are recording on April 30th. I know a lot of you, or at least listeners in China, are it's already May 1st, so I hope you're off on vacation somewhere nice for your five-ish day vacation.
Vacation sounds good to me. It's a busy time of year on my end. I've got earnings season in tech. We've got the NBA playoffs in full swing, so I'm up till 2 a.m. every night watching playoff games.
What a struggle you have to stay up and watch basketball, watch
so
NBA
hard.
Playoffs for a job. I feel bad for you.
People do not understand my burden, and yet we trudge ahead nevertheless. No, it's great to be here, though, and we do have to note we're outside the paywall this week. So, Bill, I need you on your P's and Q's. We can't get canceled on this episode.
Oh, that's a high bar, or a low bar, I guess, depending on what you're saying.
A challenge. But a reminder, if you're new and you want access to every episode of Sharp China, you can subscribe to Bill's newsletter at Cynicism or to the Stratechery Bundle, and you'll get every episode we publish each week. We'll put links to both of those in the show notes. We'll begin today with a tweet from Elon Musk on Monday. He posted a picture of himself seated across from Premier Li Chong and wrote, "Honored to meet with Premier Li Chong. We have known each other now for many years, since early Shanghai days. And as noted by Twitter user Kyle Chan and you on Cynicism, Li Chong was the party boss of Shanghai and fast-tracked the construction of Tesla's Shanghai Gigafactory in under a year, including help with land, permits, and a $1.5 billion low-interest loan." So this was pretty interesting to me. It came out of nowhere. It was a surprise on Monday. On one hand, it's a Tesla story, and we could talk about that aspect of it. On the other hand, this came a week after the U.S. passed legislation to force the divestiture of TikTok. What do you think of the PRC response? What does this say about PRC priorities?
It also, just to add, it also came a few days after pretty poor earnings by Tesla and Tesla's earlier cancellation of a trip to India that had been scheduled for last week. I think, you know, one of the things interesting, I wrote about it yesterday, really was when the bill passed last week that is going to force either divestment or ban of TikTok, you know, of course, the speculation begins, well, how will the PRC retaliate? And, you know, you look at the two biggest U.S. companies, highest profile companies with the most exposure in China, and you'd say, well, it's Apple and Tesla. And there are downsides to retaliating against both. And I think one of the reasons, that as I said yesterday, is, I mean, I actually think the Chinese were really smart in that rather than punishing Tesla for that TikTok bill, they actually decided to embrace Musk and Tesla even harder.
Right. Bear hug.
And then using and reiterating that Tesla is an example of a foreign firms that can work and be successful in the PRC, you know, can now work within this upgraded data security regime that's been, you know, driving lots of people to all sorts of levels of concern about, you know, the PRC closing down and data security, and also really basically showing to the world that, yes, we're open for business. If you come in, if you play by our rules, if you have good products, if you're doing things that are constructive for the PRC economy, we love you and we welcome you with open arms. And in fact, we'll hug you really tightly, which is what basically they've been doing with Tesla for several years. And in this case, you know, honestly, I think from the PRC perspective, this is really smart because it also, you know, Tesla stock was down a lot. I think at one point last week, it was at $140 on Monday. The meeting actually happened on Sunday, and it was during, you know, there was the Beijing Auto Show that started this weekend. Monday morning stock, you know, market opens, stock's already up crazy pre-market. I think at the end, it closed the day like 195. So the stock was up, you know, and a lot of that, I mean, this China trip was a big surprise, but, you know, Musk, most of his fortune is tied up in Tesla stock. And so the China trip added tens of billions of dollars to his net worth in, you know, one trading day. So I think, again, it was actually much smarter. In some ways, the Chinese are like, we're going to, you know, instead of smacking a big high profile company around because we're mad about TikTok, we're going to pour a bunch more honey on Elon Musk, you know, and grease him up. And, you know, everyone's much happier. And now we've even more tightly bound one of the richest men and most influential entrepreneurs in the world. We more tightly bound them to China.
Yeah.
So it's actually quite smart.
And in terms of the specifics, Tesla passed a data security process that may remove the restrictions for cars that are made in China. So Tesla's made in China. There had been restrictions on Tesla's driving in sensitive areas. Those restrictions may be lifted, which would clear the way for the rollout of full self-driving in China.
It's not all clear that that all is going to happen, and if it does, when, but it's a path. There now appears to be a pathway for that.
Right. And then Tesla also announced a mapping and navigation deal with Baidu. And as you say, Tesla's stock rose 15% on this news Monday. It did strike me as interesting that at least some people seem to be reading a lot of significance into the idea that Tesla's made in China now may not face restrictions driving around sensitive areas. From what I understood, the driving restrictions weren't that onerous. So would this really change the fate of Tesla in the Chinese market, the Chinese consumer market?
No, I think Tesla's bigger problem in the Chinese consumer market is, and we talked about this on previous podcasts, is they are, they have old models compared to the surge in really new sexy models that Chinese car makers have been pushing out, including most recently the new car from Xiaomi, I think the SU7 that, looks a lot like the Taycan. So I think it doesn't necessarily make them will cause a surge in new buyers. It certainly is onerous for existing buyers who suddenly can't get on the main road in a city because, say, some VIPs in town like Xi Jinping.
Right.
It also, though, has the benefit. One of the problems with the way that the Chinese security services had been banning Teslas from certain sensitive areas, like in some airports, parts of cities where Xi was visiting, some types of state-run enterprises, military installations, etc., was that made it very easy for people in other countries like the U.S., I think in Europe, the U.S. especially, to say, look at how the Chinese look at these vehicles. Therefore, they see them as a vector for, surveillance and espionage, if not also a way to, and of course, with the U.S. having announced they're going to do this study into whether or not there needs to be action against connected vehicles, the U.S. also is talked about the risks of the cars basically being controlled remotely.
Mm-hmm.
But I think so whether or not this move then assuages some of those concerns, I think perhaps the Chinese side would like this to have that effect too, to sort of neutralize the national security argument against importing lots of PRC connected vehicles. The issue is, I think, twofold. One is it only applies to cars made in China.
Right.
And so I don't think it really addresses those concerns about cars made in China outside of China. And two, again, the way it was worded, it may take some time for these sort of relaxations and restrictions to filter throughout different parts of the bureaucracy and different regions.
Yeah.
But it certainly is positive for Tesla. The FSD, the full self-driving announcement. The reality is Tesla's actually is actually behind. I mean, like Baidu, for example, its partner on navigation mapping, I think is way ahead in autonomous driving. They've been running all sorts of pilots. The Chinese have set up the pilot zones in Beijing and I think a couple other cities where, they're running, they're testing like Waymo tests, here in the US.
Mm.
And so, Tesla's not actually the leader when it comes to that technology now compared to some of the Chinese cars.
That was my question, because there's people out there who are saying this is sort of like a tech transfer to secure market access situation where Elon is going to be serving up the full self-driving Tesla product, and in exchange, he will be protected in China. But my assumption has always been, given how far along the EVs are and just what that sector has looked like over the last 3 or 4 years, they have to be at least close to where Tesla is. But it sounds like they're even further beyond where Tesla is, or could be.
I think Baidu is. And I think also, the challenge, is FSD, Tesla FSD doesn't seem like it's ready for prime time here. And in fact, I think it'll be interesting to see how, there's lawsuits underway against Tesla. And so, if there turn out to be real safety issues here, the Chinese actually in many ways have a better regulatory regime around this stuff. And so they're going to, if Tesla were to be approved in China for FSD, that would mean it probably actually works pretty well.
Mm.
Here, it doesn't seem to be really that regulated. here being the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, there's a thicket of regulations that are going to be a mess to sort through over the next 10 years or so. I am interested, just in the course of staying up to date for Sharp Tech, I haven't tried the latest version of Tesla's full self-driving mode, but there have been a few people who have come back in the wake of this most recent update and said, look, this is a step change in terms of capability, and we're now living in a different era of autonomous transportation.
Okay.
So I don't know. I don't know what to believe. I never know what to believe with Tesla.
Right.
I mean, I feel bad for the people who have to analyze this company as like a core part of their job, because it's just such a roller coaster. Like, they laid off the charging division on Tuesday, and so there's never a dull moment. But I'm interested, do you think the PRC side is getting anything of substance out of this exchange, or is it mostly about optics in the wake of all the crackdowns on TikTok and overcapacity and everything else?
I think a lot of it is more about optics and changing the narrative. Again, it's basically, you know, reiterating the message they've been trying to, that they keep pushing, that we are open for business, we welcome foreign enterprises, you know, trying to change the narrative around this, the data security regime, and say, look, if you go through our process, then, and you abide by our laws, then it can work for you too. And you'll be, you know, you'll be treated fairly, which is, you know, what I think is one of the good out of their the key outcomes or positive outcomes for the Chinese government from these steps. From the Tesla perspective, again, it isn't clear that this is going to change the trajectory of Tesla sales in China, which are on a problematic trend right now.
Right.
But it changes the narrative for Tesla. Again, given last week's disastrous week of the news flow around the layoffs and the earnings, it just completely changed the narrative. So that's why the stock was up big. I think it was down a little bit today. Everything was down today. But all of a sudden, people are talking about, they're not talking about the earnings anymore. They're talking about China and all this stuff.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, is a core tenet of the bear case with Tesla is they're going to run into all sorts of headwinds in the Chinese consumer market. And to the extent that that's a core part of their growth story, that's not going to be a viable path going forward.
Right. I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that this announcement of the weekend signals a change in mitigation of the problems they are facing in the PRC market.
Yeah, I think that's a safe assumption to make. And it's why I did a double take when it suddenly, okay, they passed the data security processing and they may remove the restrictions. Yeah. Well, that probably doesn't change the basic realities for Tesla, but...
And the stock, I just checked, the stock is back down to like 181 or something. I'm not that we don't, you know, not that we care about stock prices, but I mean, yesterday was a horrible day for the shorts who were really excited last week.
Yeah.
You know, it's, in some ways, it's like all the folks who, you know, who the whole China's about to collapse narrative, where, you know, every few years they get right up to the edge of like, oh my God, I'm going to finally be right.
Yeah. You know?
And then something happens and they just get blown up. And I think that's sort of what happened to some of the Tesla shorts over the last 24 hours or 36 hours.
Yeah, well, and just zooming out, the reason that I continue to find the Tesla in China story so interesting, and it may be obvious to a lot of our listeners, but it's just such a transparent look at what the bilateral relationship means to both U.S. companies and the PRC side, where China has been able to learn from the most innovative companies in the world and then apply those lessons to their own domestic companies that then compete with those companies. And then a U.S. company like Tesla is fully aware of that long-term playbook. But Tesla's a public company, and they've had all this growth priced into the value of the stock, and they just risk hemorrhaging huge amounts of value if they withdraw or don't play ball, don't go over and sit with Li Qiang during the Beijing Auto Show. So you see someone like Elon Musk lobbying against the ban of TikTok, and it's just those dynamics. It's not unique to Elon or Tesla, but it's most obvious in that case.
And it's also, you know, the timing's interesting. It comes just a couple of days after U.S. Secretary of State Blinken was there. You know, he was talking about, you know, some of the overcapacity, what the U.S. charges about overcapacity problems. You know, a couple of weeks ago, there was U.S. Treasury Secretary over there having even more sort of in-depth discussions around overcapacity. you know, and state media after Musk's visit was basically saying like this. I haven't actually found the quote from Musk himself, but sort of Musk was saying that the overcapacity in EVs is not the issue. And I think to your earlier, to the point you're just making, though, about sort of Musk going over there and stimulating the market. And now, you know, are there all these competitors in some ways? You know, yes, he wants to make money, but I think he does have a broader vision of, you know, why he made Tesla. And he, you know, he wants to change the future of mobility. He wants EVs. He wants autonomous driving. And so actually being one of the key players in stimulating all the innovation in China, you know, he's should be pretty happy with that.
A point,
you
know, of
maybe,
pride.
Maybe he's lost some business and lost some market. He's rich enough. But he was one of the key contributors to a really an incredibly dynamic and innovative market now, even though, you know, it didn't start out that way. But history is going to look back at the, what the Chinese have done in EVs is just an incredibly successful example of industrial policy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it is a little odd, though, because it's clearly the biggest long term threat to Tesla are all these competitors emerging out of the PRC, eating into its market share. And so Elon just embracing that is not how a lot of businessmen would handle it. But I think he also needs to maintain the relationship with PRC leadership.
Yeah. Well, it's like he tweeted about his opposition to the bill affecting TikTok when it was already clear that it was going to pass a few hours later in the Senate.
Right.
So it just was like,
make sure we get that on the record.
I'm on the record, even though it was completely meaningless at that point.
Yeah. So anyways, it's one example of China's soft power is control or influence over certain figures in the private business community. Any final thoughts there, or should we move to the news of the day, which is that we finally have plenum news?
I mean, I think it's the fact that, you know, again, this last couple of days, I think from the PRC side, you know, they successfully even more tightly bound Musk to the PRC. I think that's a problem from the U.S. government perspective when he's, you know, has SpaceX, when he is running Twitter or X now. You know, SpaceX has a lot of U.S. government contracts. So the U.S. government military relies on SpaceX for some space stuff. He's in a very potentially conflicted position.
Yeah, it's tenuous. And look, you see the market response to potentially improving conditions in China. And to me, if Tesla succeeding in China and maintaining this relationship is elemental to the future value of the company, I have a hard time seeing how this story ends in a good place for Tesla in the long term, but maybe I'll be wrong. And people have been doubting Tesla since its inception, and here we are. So we'll see what it turns into. But
I just think the story on Tesla, you know, the switch to sort of getting rid of the cheap model and focusing on robotaxis. The problem for Tesla is that the companies like Baidu are ahead of Tesla in China for that kind of thing.
That makes sense.
It's just, I don't, again, if you look at both sort of being a local company, but also, you know, having local development and then also, you know, just the lower cost base, if you're manufacturing in China, they're ahead of Tesla, and it's not at all clear why Tesla would be able to catch up.
Right. Even setting aside all of the political considerations, it's just a really competitive market with a number of very competent threats.
And the Cybertruck, if they ever start producing again, I mean, that's not going to have no near to medium term impact on China. They can't possibly sell a car with that many quality problems in China in any volume. And in fact, there's already at least one sort of very much lookalike Cybertruck that was at the Beijing Auto Show.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of lookalikes I've seen from the Chinese car market the last couple of years. The Taycan being the most extreme example.
Well, the Yangwang, there's a BYD one. I think it's the Yangwang 8 that looks exactly like a Land Rover Defender.
Ah, interesting.
Exactly like a Defender. Well, the newer version.
I will never buy a Cybertruck, but I would like to play with a Cybertruck for like a day. I'm curious as to what it looks like, what it feels like to drive. So if anyone wants to lend me one.
I have not seen one driving around DC. I don't know. Maybe it's more of a West Coast thing. I don't know.
Yeah. It doesn't look like much of a city car. So again, not going to be purchasing one anytime soon. To keep it moving though, I have buried the lead enough. The Politburo met on Tuesday for its April meeting, and the topic was to analyze and study the current economic situation. The meeting also decided that the third plenum will meet in July, and, quote, the main agenda will include a report by the Political Bureau to the Central Committee with a focus on studying further comprehensive deepening of reforms and advancing Chinese-style modernization. So there you have it, Bill. After months and months of speculation, we have a date for the third plenum and indications of what will be discussed. There was a lot more included in the readout from the Politburo meeting, which you helpfully translated very quickly for everyone on Cynicism on Tuesday. As you digest what's in there, is there anything you find particularly interesting about the announcement of the third plenum?
Well, first, let's go through the readout, the statement after the Politburo meeting. You know, there's two pieces. There's the announcement of the date for the third plenum, and then there's the discussion of the April Politburo meeting will talk about what they say, analyze and study the current economic situation. Okay. So there are two pieces to this readout. I think first let's talk about how they see the current economic situation, because it was released after the stock markets had closed in China on April 30th, and now they're on holiday until Monday the 6th. I think if the markets were open on Wednesday, Chinese stocks probably would have gone up, because there was some messaging in the readout signaling some measures that will probably make investors happy, might have some help for the real estate market, might have some help for easing credit conditions potentially. So I also think, though, it's important to look at first when they talk about the economy. You know, we saw the Q1 GDP number where they came out, and you know, again, whether or not you believe the number, the government says that was the number, and that fits in with what they say they need to hit for their targets this year. And so In this readout, they say that positive factors in economic operations have increased. Dynamic momentum has continued to strengthen. Social expectations have improved, and high quality development has been solidly advanced. Promoting characteristics of faster growth, optimized structure, and improved quality and efficiency, achieving a good start to the economy. So they're like, okay, things are not so bad.
Yep.
And they usually do this. And then they'll say, however, or but, even though there's improvement, there's still many challenges like insufficient demand, pressure on enterprises, lots of risks and hidden dangers. The complexity, severity, and uncertainty of the external environment have markedly increased, especially to the US, although they don't say that, but that's clearly a big factor. But at the same time, it must be recognized that China's economy has a stable foundation, multiple advantages, strong resilience, and great potential. So I think what they're saying is, look, the economy's not that bad.
Right.
Right? You know,
there are problems, but the foundation is sound.
The foundation is sound, and we have a plan, basically. They go through that, and some of the things they're going to do, they talk about ways that they're going to use more fiscal policy, tweak some things around monetary policy to potentially increase liquidity. They talk about some new language around making sure that houses that people have paid for are actually completed and delivered, which has been a big problem. But also, what's the exact word they use here? They talk about it called for coordinated research on policies and measures to digest existing housing stock, which I think people are seeing as, okay, that means the government may start being more aggressive about buying up some of this unsold housing stock and then turning it into subsidized low-income housing.
Okay.
Which again would then help developers, help the market also get a bunch of inventory off the market, et cetera. So generally, I think that this was this will be seen as a relatively positive announcement from the Politburo. No signs of a, oh my God, we have to change course. Very much, I think we are continuing with the policies we've been setting over the last, you know, really starting with the Central Financial Work Conference at the end of October last year, then that Central Economic Work Conference, then the two sessions, that this Economic Work Conference in December, the two sessions in March. Yes, we're tweaking, but the overall direction is generally correct.
Right.
And then that goes back into the discussion about the third plenum meeting. So on that one, a few things that are interesting. One, having the third plenum in July is definitely rare. It's rare to have a plenum in the summer. Mm-hmm. The third plenum especially is usually in the fall. I believe the last time there was a plenum in the summer was right after 1989. I think it was either late June or early July.
Okay.
Which obviously was a very unique time. It's also interesting that they announced it, you know, here we are April 30th, and they've announced it for July. Now, we don't know if it's July 1st or July 30th. It's sometime in July. Mm-hmm. But we're at least getting 9 or 10 weeks, if not 11 or 12 weeks of...
warning.
Of sort of advance notice.
Right.
Which I think signals that whatever they had to work through to get to what the agenda was going to be at this plenum, whether they were, you know, discussions, debates, you know, we probably won't know. They must be confident that everything has been resolved.
Okay.
That they're not going to be some sort of other problems or big debates that are going to pop up in June that they'll suddenly make, because they're not going to hold the plenum unless they know that it's going to go well and go smoothly. And basically it's baked in before they meet.
How much debate would there even be? I mean, in terms of who's setting the agenda and what
there's lots of academic input. I mean, you've seen, you know, various symposiums that we see the very, very small tip of the iceberg about sort of how people of different industries, different politicians, localities, academics, mm-hmm. entrepreneurs, sort of the various ways they try and input into the policy process. And again, in some ways, you see some of that, but ultimately we don't know. And that's why, again, there, you know, I see lots of headlines about the long delayed plenum, you know, third plenum will finally meet in July. Well, again, we've had this discussion, is the expectation was that it would be last fall, because right. most times the third plenum is held in the fall. However, the third plenum for the 19th Party Congress was held in, I think, the end of February of 2018. Because the second plenum was held to specifically make, you know, remove term limits for Xi. So there was no third plenum in the fall of 2018. And then they jumped all the way to the fall of 2019 for the fourth plenum. Mm-hmm. There is no, the requirement in the party constitution is one plenum, you know, plenum at least once a year. They had the second plenum last year in 2023. So there was no requirement that they had to have the third plenum. People assumed they would because they usually did. However, right. under Xi Jinping, lots of things that people assume they would do because they usually do have not happened.
There used to be term limits. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Well, there used to be lots of things that were sort of norms or established practices that people thought meant that this is the way things were. But actually, there's a lot more flexibility, at least in the Xi era. And so I will continue to push back on the sort of assumption that, I mean, maybe it was delayed. Maybe they really did want to have the plenum in the fall and there was some big debate, or they were trying to figure out how to have, you know, they hadn't worked through what the policy direction really should be, because, you know, mm-hmm. they were coming out of COVID. You know, there was a lot of damage done around COVID and the reentry in the early 2023. The U.S.-China relationship has obviously been, you know, got really dicey last year and has stabilized a bit, but it's still problematic. So it certainly is possible that they either couldn't come to any sort of consensus or just thought it was too early to be confident with, you know, an actual plenum. And so it was better to wait and see and watch how things develop. We don't know, but I just would caution to say the assumption that it was delayed is they also may have said, you know, we had our plenum and I'm Xi and she's making all these decisions. And, you know, you've got the Central Financial Work Conference, which hadn't been held for 6 years. You had the annual Central Economic Work Conference. You know, they might have just not felt the need to hold it.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think for anybody who's new to this issue, one of the reasons whether it was technically delayed or literally delayed in any way, it felt to people like a delay because people were seeing the struggles with the PRC economy and impatiently waiting for a stimulus and a plenum to set some sort of ambitious stimulus policy. And whether it would have happened in the fall or in the early months of 2024 or now in July, it doesn't seem like that's the direction that the PRC leadership wants to take this. To take it back to the NBA playoffs, like as some of the NBA teams flame out in the first round, it's a panic-inducing situation with some of these teams, and some teams will lose and say, we need to trade major pieces and rework our nucleus entirely, and then other teams will say, what we need to do is go get role player X and role player Y and just build out the edges of the roster in a smarter way. And it seems like what she and his team are trying to do is build out the little pieces and adopt very targeted, specific policies as opposed to the more comprehensive package that people wanted this year. And it seems like everything is trending against that sort of move here, unless I'm misreading the Politburo.
I mean, I think in the statement today, when it talks about the agenda for the plenum in July, it says, you know, a focus on studying further comprehensive deepening of reforms and advancing Chinese style modernization. So there's a whole commission on comprehensively deepening reforms, and she has been very adamant that they are comprehensively deepening reforms, and they've been doing so for many years. They, of course, are not the reforms that lots of, especially foreigners, were hoping for. Mm-hmm. You know, they were not the reforms. There was this famous third plenum of the 18th Party Congress in 2013, which was the document came out, and, you know, people got really excited because it seemed like it was, you know, had language about the market that was slightly different, and people got really excited that, oh, this is it. They're really going to be much, you know, it's a real liberalizing moment. And then here we are 11 years later. And, you know, the party says a lot of the reforms they talked about at that third plenum in 2013 have been implemented, but the economy is not what I think people, you know, sort of the way the party is running the country and the economy is not what people were hoping for when they saw that document. And so
right.
You have to be very careful about, basically projecting your sort of intellectual hopes or personal hopes for how she may reform China onto what, you know, as opposed to what they actually mean when they talk about comprehensive deepening reforms and what they actually mean about Chinese style modernization, which is very much about building China into a sort of advanced manufacturing superpower. It is about, you know, a financial system with Chinese characteristics. It's about rejecting lots of Western models of development, lots of, you know, rejecting the sort of the Western model of capitalism, financial markets. It is a very, very different thing that they're talking about. And the way I read this whole document is we have set the parameters of what we're going to do. Now we just have to figure out how to get all the pieces together.
Yeah.
But so this is not going to be a sudden, you know, change in direction. Like, for example, you know, the most famous third plenum was back when Deng Xiaoping sort of the beginnings of the reform and opening period back in, what was it, 1979 or 78.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe we'll be surprised, but just looking at this document and looking at all the other things that the leadership has been saying over the last few months, and given the way they're talking about actually how the economy's not that bad, how they're talking about national security, how they're talking about the international environment and the problems in the international environment, and specifically with the U.S., I don't see why, I can't make an argument that this all adds up to some course correction coming in July.
Right. Yeah, well, and you hit the nail on the head. We have seen what Chinese-style modernization means to Xi. We've seen what new productive forces means to Xi, high-quality development. At least over the last year or so, some of the policies that have been implemented in furtherance of those ideas have not been the stimulus cannon, and it seems like Xi does not want to restart that cycle of giant stimulus every 5 to 10 years or something like that. So I'll be very curious, though, to see what more we learn about the plenum in July, whether it happens at the beginning or the end of July. I'm just glad that we can finally celebrate the arrival of the third plenum this show.
And then if it doesn't happen in July, then something big is going on. I mean,
I think it's a delay.
The other thing is, I think I will guess that we'll see out of this plenum more concrete measures towards sort of redistribution of wealth, sort of more concrete measures to what sort of this broad concept of common prosperity, which again is probably good for large swaths of the population of the PRC, It will probably not make a lot of the sort of wealthy business elite happy.
Yeah.
But they're a minority, and frankly, they're not really the most important constituency.
Interesting. Well, but incentivizing investment in the PRC market is important long term. Is that not a concern that she would worry about?
Well, I mean, I think when you look at things like the way they talk about the financial markets and you know, the way they want to build their own financial system and rejecting a lot of the Western approaches to building financial markets and financialism is, you know, people can still make money. They just don't have to make egregious amounts of money.
Mm. Yep.
We'll see if it works. It is a very, especially when you go back and read not only the readout from the Central Financial Work Conference from last October, but also some subsequent writings by sort of party bodies involved in financial policy setting and financial oversight. It is very clear that they are talking about a rejection. And, you know, again, 2007, 2008, would you want that kind of financial system?
I was going to say
there are actually valid reasons to reject some of that, right?
Yeah,
so they're gonna try.
The challenge is you can't necessarily have the good aspects of a Western right. free market if you're not going to tolerate some of the risk and the bad aspects of it and the inequality that emerges. But there's a balance that, frankly, I wish we struck better in the West. So
and again, we'll see. And there's going to be more state capital in this financial system. There's going to be more, you know, control, you know, the big sort of, she is very big on SOEs. He is not mm-hmm. at all about privatization. He's about making the SOEs big SOEs bigger and more efficient and stronger.
Yep.
Including the financial sector. And that, I think, is clearly a part of what he describes as Chinese style modernization.
New productive forces.
Well, that, of course, is in the readout too, and that's all part of it. And that is most definitely, that is what ties into the advanced manufacturing. It ties into breaking through the U.S. stranglehold on some core technologies. It's about the sort of the technological upgrading of the entire economy and the entire industrial chain.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one of the big questions is whether or not we'll see more around consumption. And, you know, they've got this program they pushed out. I think they announced it in March, this massive sort of upgrading program for consumers and businesses, where basically you trade in old equipment, you get subsidies to get new equipment. And, you know, it will probably end up being worth several trillion renminbi over the several years it's in operation. And is that, you know, that I think is what the top leadership sees as their big consumer stimulus.
And that is not seen as enough. I mean, we literally had Janet Yellen over in Beijing 3 or 4 weeks ago saying you need to focus on stimulating domestic demand instead of stimulating the manufacturing sector. And I don't think that message was received all that well. And it doesn't seem like something that the leadership is actually going to heed in the near term, at least.
Well, again, we will find out around July if they do actually make some moves to materially increase that kind of consumption. And,
yeah.
And material, you know, they talk about increasing effective demand. I mean, this Paul Pierre readout from today talks about it. They've been talking about it for a long time. What we haven't seen and what, you know, is again, it's back to sort of what people, experts, investors, economists are saying they hope they do versus what they've actually done. And so we're guessing based on this readout, what's going to happen at the plenum. And we should know more before that actually meets, although you don't really know everything until they meet. Even then you don't actually know everything. But again, right now you can't look at this document and say they've changed plans and there's some massive new consumption program coming.
Yeah.
Could happen. The evidence is not there, at least the way I read it.
Okay, well, to keep it moving, I also wanted to follow up on the Blinken visit that we discussed last week. He did end up meeting with Xi Jinping at the end of last week. I'll read a portion of the PRC readout from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. President Xi Jinping noted that this year marks the 45th anniversary of diplomatic relations between China and the United States. Over the past 45 years, the relationship has gone through wind and rain, and the two sides could draw a few important lessons. China and the United States should be partners rather than rivals. Help each other succeed rather than hurt each other. Seek common ground and reserve differences rather than engage in vicious competition. And honor words with actions rather than say one thing but do another. He proposed mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, and win-win cooperation as the three overarching principles for the relationship. They are both lessons learned from the past and a guide for the future. And then later, from the same readout, China is willing to cooperate, but cooperation should be a two-way street. China is not afraid of competition, but competition should be about progressing together instead of playing a zero-sum game. China is committed to non-alliance, and the U.S. should not create small blocks. While each side can have its friends and partners, it should not target, oppose, or harm the other. China welcomes a confident, open, prosperous, and thriving United States and hopes the United States will also look at China's development in a positive light. So, what did you think of that statement and the signals coming from Xi at the end of last week?
So, I think overall, the meeting, there were no big surprises at the meeting. Blinken, you know, it would have been a big surprise had he not met Xi Jinping. He got his meeting with Xi Jinping. It was the same format as the meeting he had last June when he went. He was, you know, greeted by the same official and sent home by the same official on the tarmac. So the protocol appeared to be the same. I think the only obvious difference was the plants in the center of the table were different. And so there's some funny stuff going on the Chinese internet where the plants in June were like lotuses, which mean peace. And these were some other plant, which has a Chinese medicinal use for treating diarrhea. Not that that was intentional. But, I mean, again, I it's one of those things where I think people are overreading it, but it's just kind of funny. Like, you know, it's like people actually look at what, you know, I think it's also just seasonal. But
yeah, this is the information people come to Sharp China for. So well, thank I mean, you, yeah, for
you never
that.
Know, right? I mean, maybe it's like stop running your mouth, Mr. Blinken. I doubt
verbal
it. But
diarrhea.
I think,
that's for Rom.
I think yeah, exactly. Well, now Rom wouldn't be allowed in. There's a special room for him.
Yeah.
No. I mean, again, that long document that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs released last week before the trip basically hit all the high points. And so I don't think there were any real surprises. You know, I think from some of those statements from Wang Yi, you can see that things like the tech controls are causing them real concern. They're also obviously very concerned about what the U.S. has been doing with the Philippines and the U.S., Japan, Philippines and AUKUS and the Quad. And so, I mean, their U.S. actions are causing some real upset, I think, in parts of Beijing because it's complicating, just complicating their external environment. On the Russia-Ukraine stuff, it's not clear that the Chinese, you certainly have not heard that the Chinese agreed to make any changes. You know, the U.S., there was that story before Blinken went from the Wall Street Journal about the U.S. is talking about financial sanctions.
I didn't see much about that in the days following the visit.
And so maybe the Chinese are going to call the bluff, or maybe everyone's going to quiet down about it. And actually the big banks are, and there are reports that they've been it's gotten much harder to process transactions with Russia through at least the big banks. And so that may have the effect of changing some of that behavior, just the talk of real financial sanctions. On fentanyl, you know, Blinken met with the Minister of Public Security, Wang Xiaohong. Not clear how much progress is really being made.
Right.
I don't believe the number of deaths from fentanyl in the U.S. have gone down since the Woodside Summit last year. And, you know, we'll see. It's election season, you know, 6 months away from the presidential election. You know, maybe the Chinese don't want to help Biden have a win on this issue. Unclear.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unclear. I mean, this idea from the Xi readout that the U.S. needs to honor words with actions rather than say one thing but do another. I would say that both sides have been guilty of saying one thing and doing another.
It's a lot of mirroring, going on.
Yeah, the PRC is certainly in a glass house if that's a principal complaint about U.S. behavior. I saw another video of a Filipino vessel just getting pummeled by water cannons this week.
Today.
Very
today.
Unsettling. Yeah. So in any event, yeah, it seemed like a more or less uneventful couple of days for Blinken over there.
I mean, the other thing I sort of got from on the U.S. side, at least, I think there was a sense that the Chinese side was relatively calm over Taiwan. You know, I think the realization that the election outcome was sort of the, you know, the DPP won the presidency, but the KMT, you know, effectively controls the legislative yuan. It was basically the best outcome they could have hoped for. And so, and, you know, the inauguration of President-elect Lai, I think is May 20th, so 3 weeks away, that the Chinese seem to have wanted to calm that down.
Okay.
And so the U.S.
That's encouraging.
Felt that was encouraging. So I'm not sure this trip made things better, but they didn't make things worse. And, you know, now, you know, there's news today that the climate envoy from China will be visiting D.C. this in May.
Okay.
We'll see if the U.S. sends, I mean, I don't know, they should send Raimondo again. I think Huawei's about to release a new phone. You know, this is like, she should go getting her ads for the next model, right?
Yeah. They love Raimondo. If you really want to stir the pot this summer, send her back.
Yeah, you'll get a whole new Huawei. A Huawei phone will suddenly pop up, a new one. No, but you know, and then I think, but again, on the Russia-Ukraine stuff, I don't think you're going to see the Chinese make any significant changes in terms of the things that they're supplying to Russia. The stuff that the U.S. says is helping Russia rebuild its defense industrial base. She's off to Europe Sunday or
Early
Monday.
Early May, yeah.
Yeah, he's going to France, Serbia, and Hungary. You know, it's from the press reports coming out of Europe, it doesn't sound like, you know, Macron's gonna, you know, he's gonna express concerns about support for Russia, but then ask for investment to build EV plants in France.
Right.
So I think that, you know, I think that the messaging will be, the meeting will probably be a bit different than the meeting with the US side. Then what'll be interesting is Xi Jinping is gonna end up in Serbia on May 7th. This year is the 25th anniversary of the U.S.-led NATO bombing of the PRC embassy, mm-hmm. You know, in 1999 in Belgrade. And, of course, the U.S. insists that it was a mistake. They were using outdated maps. Nobody in China believes that. There's just the belief that...
Is that true among leadership also?
I think very senior folks all think that it was intentional. Three Chinese were killed. They were, maybe all three worked for Xinhua. Although, you know, there's always been talk that that was a cover for a different job. You know, there's talk that actually the Chinese in the embassy had, I guess the Serbians had shot down one of the F-117 stealth bombers.
Right.
And there was talk that there, you know, there are pieces of that in the embassy, and that's why the U.S. targeted it. In some ways, it doesn't matter. The belief is that it was intentional. And so no matter whatever the U.S. says, no one's going to believe it was an accident.
That's fascinating. I did not know that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, after it happened, you know, they went and, you know,
apologies from the U.S.
Well, there were spontaneous and then organized protests, trashed, I think, you know, parts of the U.S. embassy in Beijing.
Yeah.
It was pretty ugly. And again, if it were to happen today, I think it would be a lot uglier.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is so she will likely be in Belgrade on the May 7th. And then the question is, does he go to the memorial? Does he give some sort of a speech or make comments about NATO and about that, you know, on the 25th anniversary? And, you know, that could be an interesting signal given the backdrop of all the NATO warnings about China and the NATO warnings about Chinese support for Russia and the NATO warnings about Russia.
Yeah.
And then she's off to Hungary. And then when he gets back, I think, I don't think the date's set, but not too long after he gets back, Putin visits Beijing.
Right. Well, and that's why in terms of sanctions, the ball is in the U.S. court as far as China's relationship to Russia. It's been pretty clear that that bond is unbreakable, in at least in the short term, unless there's some sort of change in conditions. And the U.S. would be the ones that change the conditions there, because China has cast its lot at this point.
Yeah, I think it's more, I think it'd be change in leadership. I just think there's a real... she just has a different view of how the world should be ordered.
Yeah. Well, and so she is traveling to Europe. This will be the first time she makes a trip like this in 5 years. Is that right?
I think so. So 2000, well, I mean, the last year before the pandemic.
So I'm going to read a list of events from last week. This was all collected by Finbar Birmingham, the European correspondent for the South China Morning Post. Deep breath here. German federal prosecutors announced that three German nationals had been arrested on strong suspicion of spying for Chinese intelligence services. The European Commission opened their TikTok Lights launch, would expose our children to risks of addiction, anxiety, depression, eating disorders, low attention spans. A couple days later, TikTok abandoned the launch of TikTok Light. EU officials launched dramatic dawn raids against Chinese equipment surveillance manufacturer Nuketech premises in Warsaw and Rotterdam, looking for foreign subsidies. Germany arrested far-right EU lawmakers' aide on suspicions of spying for China. European Parliament votes through forced labor ban by a landslide. The ban does not mention China, but was written with Xinjiang in mind. The European Commission launches the first ever probe under its international procurement instrument into China's medical devices sector. The European Parliament votes for an urgency resolution attacking the jailing of an EU national under the national security law. Belgium summons Chinese ambassador over claims that the head of its foreign affairs committee had her phone hacked by Beijing. In Brussels, EU officials meet Chinese diplomats to tell them they plan to add more Chinese firms to the blacklist for flouting sanctions related to Russia. And then Shein was designated by the European Commission as a very large online platform under the Digital Services Act, which means it will have to comply with the most stringent rules within 4 months. That's a lot of activity as a backdrop for this trip coming from Xi in the next week or so. Do you have any idea what might be driving that flurry of activity?
It's a great question. And it's you know, on the one hand, it looks like a loss of patience in a lot of things that China's been doing. On the other hand, you know, German Chancellor was in Beijing a few weeks ago, and then the Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that Germany is watering down this investment screening program.
Interesting. Well, yeah, and Macron is trying to take Xi to the Pyrenees and charm him. So there's lots of mixed messages coming from the EU.
I think it's one of those things where, I mean, the EU is a big, complicated place, and each country obviously has its own agenda, but on the one hand, it feels like there's just like people are kind of fed up. And I think especially that the driver really has been a combination of Russia and Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And then at least for the countries with big auto industries, concerns about the EV exports. But at the same time, they can't quit China. It doesn't make sense for their economies. It doesn't make sense for their population. And so what's really going on here, you know, is it all coordinated? Is it just happens to be a coincidence? Again, I think the spying stuff, you know, there's a bit more coordination going on, but some of the other actions, it's just not at all clear.
Yeah. Well, and I mainly just wanted to note for the record that that was just a groundswell of activity on all sorts of different fronts last week. And it sort of dovetails with the discussion about A, the urgency to ban TikTok, the urgency we saw in the House to pass this foreign aid package. I just wonder whether there's elements that we are not aware of that are driving some of what we're seeing on the surface in terms of the response from both the U.S. and now the EU.
Well, I think also, I mean, the European leadership politicians, I think, are quite worried about the return of Trump. Mm. And so you also, you know, I think they quite rationally need to hedge that risk as much as possible. And part of the way you hedge that is by not going too far to piss off China.
Yes. Well,
and I think the Chinese are probably quite skillful at also encouraging that thinking.
Yep. We will see. I'm going to read one question from Ian because I'm just curious how you think about this. On the last show, you guys discussed China surpassing expectations with its first quarter GDP growth. I've never figured out what to think about Chinese economic numbers. Didn't Rhodium Group come out and say that they figured China's real 2023 GDP growth was around 1.5% when the official numbers put it at over 5%? But you guys and every media outlet seem to take official Chinese GDP growth numbers entirely at face value in analyses of how the Chinese economy is doing. Are there just different sources for economic data with varying degrees of credibility that I need to be better at recognizing? Or perhaps Chinese economic data always needs to be analyzed with a certain consistent degree of skepticism? And here's another small question. Let's say China's GDP growth is, in fact, at around 5% a year. Isn't that really pretty good? Sure, it's not the 7 to 10% that China experienced in previous decades, but it's not very consistent with the recent doom and gloom analyses of Chinese economy, is it? Is there something I'm missing here? Does GDP growth not tell the whole story, or are people really just overly pessimistic about the Chinese economy? Do you have any thoughts for Ian?
Well, for both. I mean, first off is I push back on the you guys and every media outlet seem to take official Chinese GDP growth numbers entirely at face value. When I write about it, I say the official number because that is the official number. I think to follow on to the latter part of that question, yes, it's very important to take these numbers with skepticism or a grain of salt. It's also important to recognize that this is the number that the system, you know, it's a number for the external audience. It's also a number for inside the system. And so when they set their target at around 5%, then they hit 5%. That, again, that's a metric that matters from a political perspective as well as an economic perspective. It doesn't necessarily say anything about the actual health of the economy. Okay. And so there are, I think Rhodium did their analysis and they're very smart there. There are other people who push back and say, you know, they're way too pessimistic. There, before COVID, there was this Chinese economist, I think it was Sheng Songzuo, who came out and said growth was negative. And then, of course, he got attacked. And I think there have been a lot of problems with the Chinese economic data. Some of it is actually not intentional from Beijing. And that's why they keep revising the statistic law and they keep talking about the need to prevent data fabrication, because they're up the bureaucracy from the lowest sort of administrative level up through the provincial governments up to the center in Beijing, there are incentives to exaggerate, right? Because they officials have
set KPIs. This target.
Well, they have these targets, they have these KPIs, and, you know, various bits of economic growth are part of their political KPIs. And if they want to get promoted, they have to achieve certain things. And that's, you know, the system is trying to change some of those KPIs, but it's very deeply embedded in how the entire political process works. And so there are lots of misaligned incentives that lead to problems with the data. And the Chinese government is, I think, actually quite aware of the data. But at the same time, when they come out and say growth will be around 5%, it takes something extraordinary for them to miss that target. Mm. COVID was extraordinary, where they actually missed it during Omicron, because there were too many lockdowns. But no, I would not advise anyone to take the data at face value as an indicator of the true economic health of the economy. But it is an important number because of what it says about what the political leadership wants to say about the economy and about how the economy is functioning. Okay. In terms of, and so lots of the real deep analysts, they have all sorts of other alternative measures they look at to try and figure
satellite
out what's going
imagery
on.
And stuff like all, that.
All sorts of stuff. And the answer is, to the second question, the answer is, it's probably not really healthy 5%, but it's also, like we've talked about, like, you know, the back-to-back economist covers last summer where it was like, you know, basically like world is ending. It's not that bad.
Mm-hmm. Not a full-on catastrophe.
Well, and even if it is bad, it's a different kind of system where the political apparatus, they have more ways to keep things in check. You know, that's a closed financial
stave
system.
Stave off the collapse, yeah.
To stave off the collapse than, say, a Japan or U.S. or, you know, a more open economy would have. And so I think but the debate that it's all fake and it's there's no activity. I mean, you can go too far on the other direction of saying that the numbers are just all crap.
Yeah.
Because there's obviously tons of economic activity going on in China, and they're, you know, things are not great right now. And I think that hasn't been great for quite some time, but it's the sort of muddle through versus boom or bust.
Right. No. Well, I'm grateful for the question from Ian, because people can send questions to email@sharpchina.fm. We were pressed for time on that episode, and so I didn't follow up, but that was my assumption, is that when we're talking about the official number for GDP, it's more useful for the insight that it provides into Beijing leadership than it is treated as like a definitive glimpse at what's actually happening.
Well, and one of the big sort of suggestions years ago was back to the third plenum discussions. I think it was got pretty active discussion around that 18th Party Congress third plenum back in 2013, was this hope that they would just get rid of the target altogether. Mm-hmm. Because the GDP target just creates so many strange incentives and perverse incentives. And they sort of tweaked it to sort of around, and you can sort of, but they couldn't actually get rid of that target because the system, the political system, is organized so much around hitting targets.
Yep. And everybody needs to have that as a sort of North Star.
And as a way for the center to help them manage, which is a really complex and large and unwieldy bureaucracy at multiple levels.
Okay. Well, on that note, any final thoughts before we sign off here?
We may see, you may have a chance to go do the Village Basketball Association podcast, because Premier Lee actually was, he went on an inspection tour, I think it was last week. And during his inspection tour, he actually watched one of the VBA championship games.
Ah, that's exciting.
And so not only was that like, okay, he's interested in it, but also it's a massive, I'm trying to see what day it was, a massive endorsement for the VBA.
Let's get a feed. I don't think we can travel to the VBA, but I feel like we should be able to procure some sort of live feed as the championship heats up over there. And we still have the Joe Tsai, I believe it was Joe Tsai, who was talking about an exhibition game with an NBA team. So we have that to look forward to next fall.
Well, maybe they'll fly him to the U.S. That would be fun.
That would be terrific, yes. Well, and as far as the NBA is concerned, my adopted team is the Minnesota Timberwolves, as we talk basketball here. Timberwolves were outstanding the past 2 weeks, and they also feature PRC national team star Kyle Anderson. So if any Sharp China listeners want to get on the bandwagon.
Oh, is he playing in Paris for the Chinese team?
I wonder. I mean, the Wolves are faring much better than the PRC national team did in the Philippines last summer. So I don't know whether the PRC qualified, but if they did, then yes, he should be there in Paris. And they need the help. So, hopefully.
And will Zach, is there any chance Zach Edey makes the U.S. national team, or he's not? Well, he's level.
He's Canadian, so he would have to choose Canada.
Sorry.
Yeah, and I think he would be in the mix for Canada, but it would be more fun to see him suit up for China. So we'll see what choice he makes.
Has there actually been any talk of that or not?
I haven't checked, but I know that they made Kyle Anderson. They created the loophole where he was able to be naturalized without renouncing his U.S. passport or anything. So I assume that similar.
Well, they've done that for several other athletes.
Exactly. So I think Zach Edey could do it if he wanted to, but time will tell.
Interesting. That would. I mean, he'd have to play with those. He'd have to practice, but that could make them a more formidable force.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a low bar relative to what we saw in the Philippines with the FIBA championships last summer. But in any event, it's great to see you as always. Listeners can send questions, email at sharpchina.fm. And Bill, I hope you have a great couple of days here and enjoy some rest as China goes on vacation.
Yeah, and everyone who's on their May 1st holiday, I hope you have a wonderful holiday.
Absolutely. All right.
Thanks,
we'll
Andrew.
Come back next week.
Cheers.